Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
Coming to you from Chapel Hill, it's Friday, October 28th, 2016. I'm Jeff Tiberi. On this episode, First Lady times two, to vote or not to vote, venturing into candidates' living rooms, and we'll try to find out if Tim Kaine is actually a decent harmonica player. Our expertise on this 27th episode of the WUNC Politics Podcast is Loretta Beniti, senior political reporter for Time Warner Cable News. She makes an unofficial second home at 16 West Jones Street in Raleigh, at least during the legislative sessions, and she is our guest today on the line from her office. Hello, Loretta.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being here. Yesterday, you were in Winston-Salem. We're taping this on a Friday, so Thursday. Hillary Clinton and Michelle Obama appeared at the Joel Coliseum. I think this was the first time in American political history that a current first lady campaigned for a former first lady. You've been to a lot of visits this election cycle. Was this one any different?
Oh, yeah. I would have thought that I was at a rock concert when you heard the audience roar as they were introduced. And I'll admit, most of that was probably for Michelle Obama, not for Hillary Clinton. She's extremely popular right now. But the excitement in that room when they came on stage together and when the current First Lady was speaking was something that we haven't seen a lot of on the campaign trail. We've seen excited crowds and crowds that have show a lot of support for the candidates, but this was different.
Michelle Obama being here, you know, by the accounts of many strategists, is the best surrogate for Hillary Clinton. What does it tell us, if anything, about where this race is at, that Michelle Obama is here or was here yesterday campaigning with Clinton?
Well, it tells us what we've kind of known all along. North Carolina really matters to these candidates. They both really want to win North Carolina. The fact that this is the first time that Hillary Clinton and Michelle Obama were appearing on stage together, the fact that Hillary Clinton introduced Michelle Obama at this, Michelle Obama spoke second, that they put their most popular person out there, this means that they want the voters here in North Carolina to be really excited, really fired up to get to the polls. And it's an interesting person to use, Michelle Obama, because she can speak from experience here in North Carolina. Because if you remember in 2008 when Barack Obama won in North Carolina, he won by such a narrow margin that it was down to just a couple of votes per precinct. Like, we're literally talking two or three votes per precinct. So she knows how important that get-out-the-vote effort is here.
All right. President Obama won, if memory is working correctly today, by 14,000 votes here in North Carolina in 2008. I think he lost by about 91,000 in 2012. In terms of other folks that were there, other Democrats running for office on Thursday, were there a lot? Were there Council of State Democrats? Were there legislative folks? Who else is, you know, trying to align themselves or
I saw a lot of the folks from the legislature in the audience yesterday, walking around, shaking hands, making sure that it was known to folks that they were there. Deborah Ross was actually one of the speakers on stage prior to the First Lady and Hillary Clinton taking the stage. So she got to give a big campaign speech in front of a very large audience this close to Election Day. Then we saw several of our members of Congress also were there.
Okay. Also this week, Donald Trump was back in the state, the Republican nominee for president, of course. Has his tone or message changed at all from your perspective? You know, he's trailing here in North Carolina. He's trailing nationally as we enter the final, whatever, 7-10 days or so, at least we hope, the final few days of this campaign.
I don't think his tone, it's changed that much. We're still hearing him talk about the exact same topics. I've been to I don't even know how many Donald Trump rallies, and I will say his speech is very similar at most of these rallies. He has moved into talking about what he will do for his first 100 days in office, what his plans are to do right away. So he's making that case for, if you will actually go out there and vote for me, here's what I'm going to get accomplished for you right away. He's trying to make sure that his base is fired up and those folks who want to see those things done actually get out to the polls at this point.
Loretta Beniti is our guest here on the WNC Politics Podcast. We should note that she is a graduate of one of the finest academic institutions of Central New York. That would be Syracuse University. Loretta, one of the other things that you are spending some time on right now are going into the homes of some of the leading candidates here in recent weeks. You're doing a series for Time Warner Cable called At Home. Tell us just a little bit about it.
Sure. We've been doing this for the past several election cycles that we've reached out to the leading candidates in the state, the big races, and asked them to do a different kind of interview with us. You know, we've obviously been hearing about the issues. We hear them debate back and forth. We hear the commercials and the ads that are all so negative. We actually want to learn a little bit more about the candidates and who they are as people. So we go home with them and sit down with them in their living room and talk about growing up, where they came from, their family, where they developed their values from, what they have taken from their childhood to today. In some cases, their family members join us for the interview. For Roy Cooper, we sat down with his wife and all three of his children to talk about that. Richard Burr's wife joined us to talk, you know, just a little bit about their marriage and what it's been like while he's been in office. It just gives you a different perspective on these candidates than these issues that we constantly hear them talking about.
Right. Specifically, what are some of the interesting or memorable or notable takeaways from some of these conversations or interviews that you've had?
Well, with Pat McCrory, he was, you know, he's been in public life for so long, you feel like you know everything about Pat McCrory. He sat there and talked about, you know, some of the struggles he's had in his life. He talked about when he lost his job with Duke and what it actually felt like that night when he went home and had to tell his wife of only 3 months that he had lost his job. And he says he remembers that feeling. He remembers what it feels like to lose a job. So, you know, he's talking about that. And then Roy Cooper, you get to see what kind of a family man he is. It has always been so important to him, even though he's been in elected office for so many years now, to be so involved in his children's lives. He has three girls who have all been involved in theater. He, therefore, has also now gotten involved in theater himself. He's done a few productions with them. He doesn't miss any of their performances. It's just nice to see them, the interaction with them, and see what's actually important to them.
I heard recently that Pat McCrory was a drummer growing up in high school. Did that come up? Did you know this?
He did not talk about the drumming, but we have pulled out some of his old yearbook photos from high school, and Pat McCrory definitely had long hair while he was in high school.
You, Loretta, have covered several legislatures, Raleigh, of course, but also Atlanta, Georgia, and Richmond, Virginia. The governor, for part of the time when you were in the Commonwealth of Virginia, was Tim Kaine, who is now the vice presidential nominee on the Democratic side. Tell us a little bit about the working relationship with Tim Kaine, to whatever extent you're comfortable doing so.
Well, it's so funny to see him out on the campaign trail now. We saw each other not that long after he got the nomination, and it was kind of like we both shook our heads because who would have thought now that I'm in North Carolina, he's on the ticket for vice president. The relationship between governors and the press corps in Virginia is kind of a unique one. It's one that's pretty close. They have very close working relationships. The governor's mansion is right on the property where the legislative building is and where the state capitol is, and as is the governor's office. So we're constantly working with them very closely. They come over. He would regularly come over and talk to the press corps and make sure there was nothing that we needed from them. I always laugh about one of the funny stories when they didn't want to actually call a press conference because they didn't need all of the media all over the state coming there, but they knew there were those of us who covered it every day that needed to ask a question about something that was happening in the legislature. We'd get a phone call from his press assistant who would say, you know, the governor is really thirsty right now. I think he's going to go get a drink in a few minutes. And that was our cue to show up outside of the cafeteria so that we could go talk to Tim Kaine about whatever it was that we needed to get some information from him about.
A very different relationship than the press corps currently has with Governor McCrory and even with Bev Perdue to go on both party lines. That doesn't really exist here in Raleigh, at least in my limited experience covering the legislature.
I will tell you, it was a little bit of culture shock when I moved to North Carolina, having come from covering Virginia, where we had Tim Kaine, prior to him was Mark Warner, and they had such strong relationships with the press corps. And I came here, and it was the end of Mike Easley's administration, went into Beth Perdue, and now Pat McCrory. And no, you don't have nearly the amount of access that we had up in Virginia.
All right. To take it a step further, I have heard stories about Tim Kaine and local watering holes and harmonica playing, and evidently pretty decent harmonica playing. Have you seen in person? Yeah, go ahead.
I have heard him play his harmonica before, and yes, he is quite good at it. And you know, right, the governor's mansion in Virginia is right near the downtown area, and there's a lot of bars down in that area, and it is not an unusual sight when he was governor to see him stop by one of the bars, and perhaps if there was a local band playing, stop and play his harmonica with the band for a little while. He also, it's very common in Virginia that the governor will have receptions at the governor's mansion. They would even have one for the press, again, something we don't see down here. And the governor always had his harmonica out there during the parties and receptions. It's just his way of relaxing, and it's great entertainment for everybody else.
That's wow. That's pretty cool. I wanted to chat, throw, I guess, probably some quicker ones at you. There are some newsrooms throughout the country that have policies on reporters or journalists voting. Wondering and asking a couple of different reporters about this issue, do you have a philosophy on whether or not reporters and journalists should vote? And if you're able to share, do you all have any kind of policy within your newsroom about casting a ballot?
We do not have a policy in our newsroom about it. It's been something that I have struggled with, actually, over the years, deciding whether or not to vote. I certainly never vote in primary elections because, as a reporter, I don't want it to look as though I'm picking one party over another party to vote in. I also do feel like I cover these people, and I certainly understand the argument of not voting and just covering whoever wins and whatever ends up happening after that person wins, and covering everything leading up to the actual election.
Sure. Will you vote this year?
I haven't decided yet. Okay. I'll tell you, I did not vote 4 years ago.
Okay. What's one election? What's one issue that you expected to get more play during this election cycle that has not received as much attention as you might have thought it would have?
Jeez, that might be a hard one. I feel like on the state level that I thought we might hear even more about education issues because it's constantly something that's being bombarded at us throughout every year. And I think that it just has kind of gotten lost in the governor's race this year because you have things like HB2 or Coal Ash that are a little bit flashier headlines to talk about. So I actually don't think we're talking about the education issues as much as we do on non-election years.
As for HB2, what is the most underreported component of HB2, whether that's part of the policy, how we got to having an HB2, the economic effects. What's the most
underreported?
Yeah, underreported.
I feel like the HB2 has been pretty well covered. But I don't think that a lot of people are aware of what HB2 does beyond just the so-called bathroom part of the policy. The parts that saying that local governments can't have higher minimum wages for folks, that they can't go anything beyond what the state says it can be. There's a lot of local governments that part of the bill really upsets them and that they don't like that has been taken away from them.
Right. Subcontractors, contractors, and of course, municipalities can't pass any sort of non-discrimination policy of their own either on the heels of HB2. In terms of a prediction, what's one possible surprise that you think could come out of November 8th?
At this point, I'm not sure anything would surprise me coming out of November 8th. I think that we might see a very different makeup of the Council of State after November 8th, which obviously they're not the most powerful positions in the state, but they are statewide elected offices, and I think that we're going to see some changes in them.
if the Republicans in the North Carolina House do not maintain a supermajority, how significant is that in terms of the nature of policy that we'll see over the next 2 years?
It depends how much of a not supermajority they don't maintain, because if it's only one or two votes, there are a couple of Democrats who are going to get reelected that are very moderate Democrats that I still think that Republicans would be able to convince in certain cases to cross the aisle and override any veto that might be coming down towards them.
Regardless of whether that's a McCrory veto or a Cooper veto?
A McCrory veto or a Cooper veto.
Okay. Sorry, I cut you off.
Which I know that sounds hard to believe that with a Democrat as governor that a Democrat might cross the aisle, but some of these folks are pretty moderate, and I don't think that they necessarily are going to be as concerned with whether or not the governor is Republican or Democrat.
And so if the magic number for Democrats in the House, I think it's four, they need to pick up four seats to break up a supermajority. Essentially what you're saying is ultimately they might need seven or eight seats to have more of a lasting effect or impact.
They have more of a lasting effect.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. As I mentioned before, you've covered three state capitals, Raleigh, Richmond, Atlanta. If you could have the opportunity to spend 1 month at another capital legislature elsewhere in the U.S., where would you go?
I think that it might be interesting to be in Colorado. I think that their state laws, they're very progressive with their state laws. It's interesting to watch how that all happens. And I also just think politics in Illinois is always fascinating.
Fair enough. Pretty corrupt. some entertainment.
I look for the sensational stories.
Sure. What story or stories, and not to give too much away, but are there particular things that you're hoping to get to report on come November, December, January, once the steady stream of stumps hopefully come to a halt?
Well, I'm really trying to start now at this point to get a sense of what the legislature is going to do when they come back in January, because, you know, for the last 4 years, we've watched this Republican control and then really push through the agenda that the conservative members want. A lot of that agenda is through. So I'm very curious as to what the next steps are for the state, if we're going to see a lot of legislation moving through at this point. And so I'd like to spend some time really looking at what's next.
Do you have a hunch? Is it more tax policy? Is it university and education shifts, or we'll table it?
I don't think that it is much more tax policy. I think that they've made a substantial amount of changes with tax policy, and I think with Senator Rucho not running for reelection, he was really a big one on pushing the tax policy changes. I'm not saying that there won't be minor tweaks here or there, but I don't think that it's going to be at the top of the agenda. Education, I think, might be interesting. I think there are some changes that are going to be done at the university level, and I think there are some changes that will be done in the K-12 level. They didn't really get so much done with what they wanted to do about getting rid of Common Core and moving into something else, and that kind of all got lost in the last session. So I do think we're going to have more discussion about that.
This is probably a little bit of a wonky question, but if people are still listening, they might have the appetite for a wonky question. Tom Apodaca has retired from the General Assembly, which for us means that the entertainment value is going to be down a little bit. But from a practical policy standpoint, this was the rules chair in the Senate. This is somebody that, from my vantage point, helped to steer the ship, to drive things forward. How much is the sausage-making policy process going to be changed? How much is the General Assembly going to miss Tom Apodaca?
I think it's going to miss it tremendously. It's going to be the same type of loss we had from several years ago when Tony Rand left the Senate. Tom Apodaca and Tony Rand are very similar personality-wise. That's what people now are coming to expect as a rules chairman in the legislature. Without having Tom Apodaca there and his institutional knowledge, you now need to find somebody else in the Senate who will know all of the little rules and their ways around things, and if they don't want something to come up or if they don't want an amendment to be heard so that they don't have to vote on it, and when's the right time to put this piece of legislation on the floor so that it gets the vote precisely that we want it to get, that's really going to change. And I think you're probably going to see some quote-unquote mistakes made in the early part of session as some, whoever steps into that role starts learning the process for it.
You said mistakes. I was thinking of growing pains in my head, but I'm wondering if you think it's more likely that, and here we go with predictions, and it's still October. Do you think it's more likely that this session is going to wrap up in early July, or are we, you know, more likely to see a session that extends again into September, like the long session 2 years ago? It's very early for me to be asking you this question.
Yeah, unless I'm missing something that's going to be happening during this session that I'm not thinking of some major thing that's going to come up, I feel like they're going to try to get out in early July because they don't have quite as much stuff that they need to get accomplished. That being said, if we're losing some people who have been around for a while that did not run for re-election this time, so it's going to be new people learning to negotiate with each other, and that's either going to bring, you know, some fresh air into that negotiating room, or it's going to slow things down to a halt.
Well, it's been great. Thanks for coming on, and I'll see you presumably somewhere. Where will you be on election night?
I'm going to be at the Democratic Party on election night.
Downtown Raleigh, the Marriott.
Yep.
Yep, I'll be there as well. All right, well, I will see you there, if not before. Thanks for coming on, Loretta.
Thank you.
All right, that will do it. Please feel free to share this episode on Twitter and or Facebook. Share feedback. Drop us a question there as well. And here's another good idea. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. And, of course, find all the latest public radio political stories at our website, wunc.org. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Have a good weekend.